ignoring the people of his state. Won't listen, won't bargain, won't negotiate. That's why there's 14 senators sneaking across the border. 14 senators, capital disorder. 14 senators, new Wisconsin heroes. What's the score? Senators 14, Governor Walker 0. Protests are growing.
Good morning and welcome to a special Sunday edition of the Sarah Schultz Show, where we the people are now in session. This is day 87 of Hollis Malin's hunger strike. So if you haven't been able to go down and see him to thank him or get him some water, he's down in Madison right in front of the Capitol. Go and say hi and thank him. He's also a vet. So very important, the stuff he's doing, and it's important that people know that we support him. And I have a great show coming up for you today. I want to remind you, this is my first two-hour show, so we will go until 12:30 today. Good thing the Packers played on Thursday, right? But 12:30 today. I will have Norm Stockwell from WORT will be on shortly. Then you'll have a recorded interview with Frank Kane with Save the Water's Edge, followed by Chris Liebenthal, our favorite blogger who writes Cognitive Dissidence. And we're going to end the show today with Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup with Yuri Rashkin. So if you have any questions or comments, the phone number to call in is 310-742-1896, and my new toll-free number is 877-497-1797. I have a live discussion online at blogtalkradio.com at some point if I can get it to work again. So if you can go on and ask a question there, I can get it answered on air for you. You can also download my show as a free podcast on iTunes or from my show page at www.blogtalkradio.com/Sarah Schultz, and you can find me on my Facebook page, The Sarah Schultz Show. Now, I'd like to start this week's show with a thank you. I want to thank all the first responders. Today is the 10th anniversary for the attacks on the towers in New York, and these people, they really put their lives on the line, and obviously many of them lost their lives doing this. And it's just not something that happens at 9/11. It's something that happens every day. You have firefighters and policemen, ambulances, anyone who puts their life on the line every day for us without thinking, without regard. I just wanted to thank them. And regarding those first responders in 9/11, they are still having health issues. There's still a lot of problems. They've had bills passed, but the bills passed have a lot of little things in them, like you have to prove you were there and you have to prove you're not a terrorist. It just boggles the mind why the government doesn't step in and help these first responders. Many of them, well, not many, some of them have died from complications for being there when the buildings collapsed on 9/11. So support them. And when you see someone, see a first responder, just thank them today for their support and all that they've done, because it just wasn't the people in New York. They came from all over the country to help out. With that being said, I would like to start out with Norm Stockwell. Norm served as WORT's operations coordinator. He has been working at the station in music and news programming since 1983. In addition to working as a journalist in the U.S., Cuba, Nicaragua, and Mexico, Norm has been involved in the collective management of two Madison institutions, Lakeside Press and Mifflin Street Co-op. He is also former director of the Old Town School of Folk Music Madison and served in the 1970s as facilities manager for the Northwest University Archaeological Program. And he's got a lot more in the bio, but I'm just going to read that paragraph first. Good morning, Norm. How are you today?
Good morning. Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
So we're going to be talking a little bit about community radio, but first, can you say why community radio is important?
Well, I mean, I think community radio is important because it provides a voice for people from the community. You know, you started off talking about September 11th, of course, today, the anniversary of September 11th, 10 years ago. It was community radio that really discussed the issues behind the issues. It was community radio stations that brought you the deeper analysis and the deeper discussion of what was going on, whether or not the war in Afghanistan was a good idea, whether or not the war in Iraq was a good idea. Those conversations were had on community radio in ways that commercial radio did not cover.
So other than bringing local news, what else does community radio bring to a community?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, community radio is really a different kind of creature than commercial radio. Commercial radio is about selling listeners to advertisers. What commercial radio tries to do is get a lot of listeners so they can turn around to their advertisers and say, we have this many listeners, so you should pay us this much for your ads. Community radio is about giving programming to listeners and giving voice to communities. And so, you know, it might be your neighbor, it might be the person down the street that's doing a program about some topic that they have a special passion, a special knowledge, a special interest in, maybe a particular type of music, maybe a particular type of poetry or literature, or some news issue. And they'll come on and they'll share their special knowledge and their passion with the listeners. And usually the listeners are able to participate in some way, like your show on Blog Talk Radio. People can call in and ask questions during the show. Well, imagine that on a music show. Imagine people calling in and saying, oh, I really like that piece of classical music you just played. Tell me more about it. It's an interactive form of radio that isn't available in the commercial sphere.
Speaking of calling, if anyone has any questions for Norm, please call in at 310-742-1896 or my toll-free line at 877-497-1797. When you're in there, if you want to ask a question, please press 1 to get you into the queue for the phones. So, and how important is it to have independent voices that are heard on these community radio stations?
Well, you know, I mean, I have always argued that community radio is an essential component of a free and democratic society. And let me explain a little bit about what I mean by that. You know, the way that our particular form of government is set up, we elect representatives to go to Washington to represent us. Well, how do they know what it is we want? And how do we know what it is we want without in-depth discussion of the issues? And so what community radio does is it helps educate people about the nuance, about the different facets of an issue. And then they can turn around and they can contact their elected representatives and say, you know, well, this thing is really important to me because of X, Y, and Z. So they communicate that to their representatives. Their representatives then, you know, vote on their behalf. So it creates an informed electorate, which can then participate in the democratic process in a way that you can't do if you only have one opinion or if you only have a 30-second soundbite about an issue, or less than 30 seconds now on a lot of commercial news shows. You know, it's a chance to really explore something in depth and gain a better understanding of it so that you as a citizen can participate in the governance of your country.
And it brings the ability for people to hear local news. A lot of times on the regular news, you hear a lot of national, but you don't hear what's going on around the state or around in your area.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, again, as I said earlier, the commercial radio model is really about selling listeners to advertisers, and so their news is infotainment. They're looking for the big flashy the smoke, the sirens. Community radio news is more about giving people information about issues that affect their lives and then giving them tools to become active around those issues. And so it's a very local approach, and it's giving voice to unrepresented and underrepresented sectors of the community so that you really understand an issue from all sides and get down to the depth of what's going on, how it affects people in their everyday living situations. And it is a very local, I mean, we also, on our community radio station, WORT in Madison, we also have international and national news through programs like the BBC and Democracy Now! And Free Speech Radio News. But our focus at the station is on covering our local community and serving our local community with news, information, and cultural programming. So we try to have, you know, local bands and local artists that are performing in town as well. But it's that connection to the local community, that service to the local audience that we really try to focus on.
Now, wasn't there an incident in North Dakota and then there maybe in Nebraska as well where local stations could have been really utilized and they weren't because there weren't any?
Yeah, you know, there's several stories about this. The one that you're referring to in North Dakota was a chemical spill where they were unable to inform people in the local area because all of the radio stations in that area where the spill took place were satellite stations. That is, they were stations that were owned by another entity somewhere else, and they were being fed pre-recorded programming from a distant location. They had no local staff, no local news. Most recently in Austin, Texas, there were the huge fires in Texas that are still raging right now, and there were no local Spanish language radio stations to serve the local Spanish-speaking community with information. There were only stations that were playing programming that was pre-recorded and fed from other locations. So the local connection, not only for, as I was saying earlier, sort of discussion of important issues, but for warnings about things that really are threats to people, that's another place where community radio and small local radio can play a huge, important, critical role.
Well, we have a caller online. Let me get to them. Hello, caller.
Hi. This is Dale here.
Hi, Dale. What's
How
your question?
You?
I'm good. Well, how are you?
Okay. We've got a station open up here. We've got a low-power FM station in the Columbus area. It's doing great. Originally opened with six groups sharing. Four of them dropped out. And we have now an AM station opening up that used to be a liberal radio station. So people are talking about maybe getting that back on the air as an AM station that's not really high power, but, I mean, it's, you know, we had Air America on there and a whole bunch of liberal other things. It seems like the corporations don't like democracy. They don't like free speech. They want to control everything and everybody, and it's gotten to the point, you know, where we should have been doing this a long time ago, but when you got money and power, it's hard to fight, right? But about fundraising for that, for an AM station. Do you have any suggestions for that, possibly?
Well, I can tell you that the model of funding that we use in the community radio world got its start actually in 1949, and I want to tell this story if you'll give me a minute. A guy by the name of Lewis Hill, who was a conscientious objector during World War II, but had also worked in commercial radio, decided that there really needed to be a radio network that was not commercial, where you didn't have to stop in the middle of the news and do a soap commercial, you know, where you could really discuss issues in depth. And he also felt that there should be a radio network that was a voice for peace, because he said all of the other commercial radio networks were just beating the drums for war. So he started the Pacifica Radio Network in 1949 with a single FM station in San Francisco. And the model that they used was they came on the air and they said, if you like the programming you're listening to, send us some money. And they were actually amazed that people sent in money. This was a very new concept. Now, of course, it's used by public television, public radio, community radio across the country. But this idea of asking listeners to contribute to something because they value the programming, rather than the commercial radio model where you have advertisers on there that are making money off of selling some product, and they're basically giving money to the station to stay on the air so they can sell that product. In the community radio world, what we do is we ask listeners to support the programming because it's something of value to them. And it has worked very well. Our station is 35 years old and is sustained. Over 65% of our income comes from individual listener donations. We get some grant money. We get some money from doing special events, things like that. But the majority of our money comes from individual listener donations of $5, $10, $15 at a time.
Yeah, they do air Pacifica here in town, and the public funding thing just seems to fall flat, especially when people are out of work and so forth. And you notice the Koch brothers, even though they've got all this money, are still getting government funding for projects that they're applying for constantly. So, I mean, grant money and things like that, I'm sure is available out there for these projects. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I will say one other thing, which is that in the community radio world, we try to have a real diverse base of funding instead of having one single donor that's contributing. You know, you mentioned the Koch brothers as an example. Rather, we try to have lots and lots and lots of small donors and lots of different sources so that the people that are donating the money aren't controlling what goes on the air. Rather, they're supporting it, but they're not basically, you don't have to sit there and worry, oh, if the Koch brothers pull their funding from this, we have to shut our radio station down. Rather, you say, we are representing the interests of all of these different diverse listeners and sometimes business sponsors as well that are supporting our station in small ways to make up this whole.
Thanks, Dale, for the call. That really leads me to another question. If people are interested in helping out their local community radio station, how can they do that?
Well, I mean, again, it's all local. I mean, in each situation, you know, a local station is trying to get money from its local community of listeners. And so in our case, we do pledge drives 3 times a year and ask listeners to call in their support. We also have a space on the web where people can pledge their support on the internet. We do special events, things like that. But all of it is, a very local experience. So people should support their stations locally by contributing to local stations, but you can also contribute to other stations around the country. If you like the idea of community radio being on the air in, Western Washington, there's a station there that has a website and you can contact them. If you like the idea of community radio being on the air in Central Maryland, there's a station there. You can go on the web and find them and put some money towards their operation as well.
And if you don't have a community radio station in your area, how can people start one?
Well, you know, all of broadcast radio in the United States is licensed by the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission. And they open windows for applications. That is, they have time periods where they say, okay, now during this, week or 2 week period, people can send in their applications to get a radio license. It doesn't cost anything for a non-commercial license except for the fees that you spend on the engineering studies and the equipment and so on, but you don't pay for the license itself. Commercial stations actually pay for their license, although the fee is not that great. But to start a community radio station, you have to first wait for one of these windows to open. Now, for full-power community radio, which is stations that are over 1,000 watts, the first time a window opened in about 15 years was the fall of 2006, I think it was. There probably won't be another one for a while. For low-power stations, low power is between 100 and 1,000 watts, and those low-power stations, for the first time in about 5 years, there's going to be a window opening probably in June of next year. That date hasn't been set yet, but that's a chance for people to get a low-power FM station. And I'm sorry, I misspoke. It's between 10 and 100 watts is what I meant to say. Those low-power stations are going to be probably there'll be a week in June of 2012 where people can apply for a station, and that's going to be the first time since the year 2000 when that has happened.
If people want more information on that, where's the best place they can go?
Well, the group that's helping get low-power stations on the air around the country is an entity called the Prometheus Radio Project, and it's named after the Greek myth of Prometheus who stole fire from the gods. The Prometheus Radio Project helped get stations on in 1999, 2000, when that last window opened, and they are now helping again to get stations started. Their website, PrometheusRadio.org, on the web, has a lot of information which allows stations to sort of find out what's involved, how to get a station started, how to form a group to apply for a license. And so that's the first place I would go for information.
And I'll put that on my Facebook page, PrometheusRadio.org, so people can just click on the link and they can go and get that information. Now, if there were no community stations, if it was just all stations that were commercial, how would the media be different? How would radio be different?
Well, I mean, again, I think that, commercial stations are limited in the sense that they have a particular way of operating, which is being, subject to commercials and therefore subject to the whims of corporate America, and community stations have a very different model, and that model is about serving local communities. So I think we would have a great loss in our world if we did not have these, entities that were basically giving voice to local issues, local communities. Commercial radio is not designed to do that, and commercial radio is not designed to give the kind of in-depth coverage, the kind of real thorough treatment of issues the way that community radio can do.
And if people wanted to go to WART or maybe donate to WART or help out at WART, where's the best place they can go to do that?
Well, our radio station has a website on the internet, www.wortfm.org, and that's where people can not only find out more about the station, listen to programming either live or the archives of past shows, and you can also donate to support the station as well.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today, Norm, to discuss community radio and its importance in our community. I'd like to have you back on, maybe get more some more detailed information about some of this, maybe as Prometheus, the Prometheus radio stuff keeps going, we can talk a little bit more about that, or when FCC opens up their window, we can talk a little bit more about that and what people need to do.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. Glad to be on. And I do encourage people to look into community radio. If you don't have one in your community, then, maybe try and work on starting one. Or if you have a station in your community, participate in some way. Join together with them and maybe volunteer some of your time or donate some funds to help that radio station, and also use them as a resource, as a way to get out the news and information about your issue in your community. So that's really what community radio is all about. It needs your participation, and I encourage you to do so.
Great. Well, thank you so much, and have a great day, Norm. Thanks for being on.
Thanks a lot.
That was Norm Stockwell from WORT, and again, their website is www.ortfm.org. I'll put that on my Facebook page, and go in and look into WORT, see how a really good community radio station's done, and then go to your local community radio station, see where you can help out, and if you can donate time, money. I'm sure they could use anything that you could give them. Now is going to be the WIN 3-Minute News.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Is Hyatt the worst hotel employer? Workers on a week-long strike against Hyatt say yes. Jesse Russell reports.
Week-long strikes against Hyatt hotels in four major cities were launched yesterday. Workers at Hyatt's in Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Honolulu are walking the picket lines to bring attention to a chain they call the worst employer in the hotel industry. In a press release, the workers cite multiple examples of abuse, including three Boston Hyatts where the entire housekeeping staff of each hotel was fired and replaced by minimum wage temp workers. The hotel chain has additionally received 15 workplace safety citations at 10 hotels, amounting to nearly $100,000 in fines. The employees in Chicago, San Francisco, and Los Angeles have been without contracts since 2009. The contract for the Honolulu workers expired in June of 2010. This is the first time since the contracts began expiring that the union representing the workers has called for a week-long strike. In the past, the workers have staged a series of one-day walkouts. Unite Here has stated on multiple occasions that the strike actions aren't over wages and benefits, but instead propose changes to work rules.
Poverty in America has increased for four straight years, and the working poor now account for 56.7% of all poor people in the U.S., according to census figures. University of Michigan professor Sheldon Danziger says that low wages for workers is a serious problem, and those wages are not rising for the average worker. Danziger says wages have been stagnating for decades, but unions, despite representing a small percentage of the total workforce, have managed to keep wages for their members higher.
The wages of workers have been eroding for 30 years, and unions have done a better job of protecting the wages of their workers. And so now people are saying, oh, unionized workers are making, you know, X percent more than private sector workers. Well, one of the responses is, what can we do to raise the wages of private sector workers?
Instead, Danziger notes, we're witnessing attacks on union workers to drag their wages down rather than boosting the low wages of other workers. We won't reduce the number of working poor by lowering union worker wages. Danziger says to really attack poverty, wages for average workers must rise. He says he would welcome a 21st century version of the war on poverty to reduce the numbers of working poor Americans. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Now, I want to play for you a recorded interview I had with Frank Kane from Save the Water's Edge. That is an organization that's up north, up by Ashland, I believe. And they've been working a lot with the mine and following what's going on with the Pinoki mine. So let me get that started.
I'd like to welcome Frank Kane to the Sarah Schultz Show. Frank is the editor for the group The Water's Edge and is president of the Pinoki Hills Education Project up north in Ashland. Thank you for coming to the show today, Frank.
Well, thank you.
Well, we're going to focus on the Pinoki mine today. That's just one of the many mines that are jockeying into position to dig up and destroy the pristine environment that is going on in the northern part of our state. What's the latest information on the mine?
Well, right now, the company has said the mining project is on hold. We're fairly convinced that they have done some test drilling this summer and are expecting the results of the test drilling, if it was done from DNR, in the next week or so. The mine is on hold because the attempt to change the mining regulations earlier this year fell off the table. The 183-page proposal was unacceptable to most anyone that owned land or was concerned about clean water in Wisconsin. And now that proposal is being rewritten to replace our mining laws. We're not certain if it's going to replace the sulfide mining laws or the metallic iron ore mining laws we have. That's all fairly confusing. The genesis of changing these laws came from Gogebic Taconite, referred to as GTAC, as they made a presentation in Ashland, Wisconsin, at the Northern Great Lakes Visitor Center in early January. They pointed out that they would begin mining in the Pinokis. It could be anywhere from a 30-year to a 110-year project there were millions and millions and millions of dollars to be made, and the most important statement they made at the time was that they could operate this mine with the very strict mining laws that Wisconsin has. At the same time, they were trying to rewrite the laws. So why are these laws so important in the Pinokies? The Pinokies are located in Ashland and Iron County. They stretch along Highway 77 from roughly Mellon, Wisconsin to Hurley. That is the heart and soul of the Bad River watershed. The Bad River watershed contains 70, 80 miles of pristine trout streams and beautiful waterfalls. One of the largest unstretched, unspoiled natural systems in the state of Wisconsin. It's the homeland of the Bad River Bend of Lake Superior Ojibwe. Also, all of the water that flows through the Pinokies and through the Bad River watershed flows into the Kakagan Sloughs, which empty into Lake Superior. The Kakagan Sloughs have one of the largest natural wild rice beds in North America. The Kakagan Sloughs are the largest sloughs on Lake Superior and provide the traditional spawning grounds for the Lake Superior sturgeon and the nursery areas for the walleye that we find in the rivers and lakes and streams and in northern Wisconsin and, of course, in Lake Superior. The effect of the mine to their first proposal is to build or to dig a 4-mile-long, 1,500-foot-deep, mile-and-a-half-wide open-pit mine. This would eventually extend either in one long mine or a series of smaller mines, some 24 to 25 miles from roughly Upson, Wisconsin to west of Mellon, Wisconsin, in what's called the Pinoki Hills. The Bad River that flows through this area actually flows around the Pinoki Hills. So any taconite tailings, any degradation of the streams to the south of Pinokies will flow right into the Kakagan Slough also.
So you're talking about the destruction of an entire ecosystem, basically, with the rice and the walleye, and you're talking about where the fishermen come up to. That's just going to be gone.
It's a destruction of a total ecosystem. The water that leaves the Pinokies takes roughly 50 years, we're told by hydrologists, to filter through the natural systems and eventually get into the groundwater, which people drink, and flow on up into Ashland to Mellon to the other small communities and on up to the Bad River Reservation. Now, the water that filters through this filters through rock, gold, silver, all the minerals that are in this in the Pinokies. We take those out and we make these big gaping holes. The water is going to flow into those big gaping holes and need to be pumped out. That water hasn't been filtered. So how is that water going to be filtered? The questions we ask the company is, how are you going to pump the water out? That's proprietary. How many gallons of water are you going to pump out? That's proprietary. Where are you going to get the water for doing the drilling process? That's proprietary, but we think we'll get it from one of the towns up there, Mellon, from their water system. So now we're working on getting all of the compliance records from the city of Mellon, because if we're going to take chlorinated water and infuse it into this natural system, how is the chlorinated water going to be kept out of the natural system? What is that chlorine? What effect will that chlorine have on the natural system? And, you know, the company doesn't have answers for those questions. And with the timeline that they're trying to pass in the new regulation, there won't be time to get answers to these questions. These questions have never been asked before. And we have too many people in the legislature, and I have to mention the Fitzgerald brothers. I think it's Jeff and Scott that, after being over there for 3 days, you know, I have people in their own party telling me that they just stand up and scream, jobs, jobs, jobs. Well, jobs are important, but at what expense? And the promotion of the project is on such a fast track that many people don't even have a chance to sit down and say, am I in favor of the mine or opposed to the mine? We don't even know what the process is, because there are no answers coming forth. And the company, of course, wants to stack the deck to produce taconite to make money. And, of course, now we're confronted with this big, raging debate about jobs. And, you know, I say to these legislators as I wandered around, why all of a sudden does anybody give a good damn about whether people are working in northern Wisconsin? They haven't for the last 40 or 50 years. And the only reason they are now is so Becerra's, Erie, and Caterpillar can sell more equipment, because it creates jobs in Milwaukee. And if we create jobs in Milwaukee, that makes everybody down here smile. And if we blow up the Pinokies up north, well, that's just a casualty of employment. All of the interest when they talk about jobs needs to be focused on good, healthy employment. And we're not doing that. We're looking at saying, well, we're going to change the laws, we're going to develop a mine, and we're going to produce jobs. And the reason we're going to do this is we're going to pass new mining laws that are called jobs for generations. This is ridiculous. That's not good government. That's just outrageous behavior by people who are disconnected from clean water and from the earth. So our mission is to talk to the unions, to talk to the people who live in Milwaukee and say, hey, do you like to come up north and go snowmobiling? Do you like to come up north and go fishing? Do you like the knowledge that there's a place in northern Wisconsin that you can still take your grandkids and your children and see bears and wolves and coyotes and fishers and see a natural system that is working very well? What is that worth? And what will that be worth 50, 60 years from now or 100 years from now? We seem to think it'll be priceless. The ore they're taking out, I don't believe any of it will be used in the United States. My sense is that's going to go into the foreign markets. And we don't have a lot of evidence to that, but if we look at who is buying the ore around the world, we see that some countries are just going off the charts and they're buying up all these mineral resources they can. And that will be the place that this ore ends up. So the extraction of the minerals from the Pinokies in the minds of too many people creates some factory jobs, don't create sustainable employment in northern Wisconsin, leave behind a mess. One just needs to take a ride up to the Iron Range in Minnesota and look at the water quality issues, the cleanup problems, look at the population, look at what the long-term effect has been on our economy, and draw their own conclusions. Some of the people in northern Minnesota are doing that now, and they're not particularly happy with the results.
Well, it's not just the mine that they're talking about putting in. They're talking about putting in a whole infrastructure up north. It's not just one mine. It's railroad tracks. It's everything, isn't it?
Well, it's railroad tracks. The tracks are, all of the 80-pound track will have to be replaced with heavier track. Will we lose the snowmobile trails and four-wheeler trails that are the backbone of a $100 million industry? No one seems to be stepping forth with those answers. If they're going to use the old rail right-of-ways, which they will probably have to do to put in new railroad tracks, that's going to take away tourist opportunities. If we're going to put those train track in, now we're going to have to build some roads. because we're going to have to get their mineral to the track, so we're going to have to build systems to get electricity, to get power up there. And now we're told they're looking at building a manufacturing plant to produce the taconite pellets, which not only leave behind taconite tailings from the blasting, which will be extensive, but we'll have the dust that's left over from making these pellets. And these pellets, making the pellets, is a lot of water is used. For every ton of pellets, we're told by the industry, not by the mining company, but by the industry in Minnesota, it takes from 1,700 to 1,900 gallons of water. So we'll say 1,800 gallons of water. If you're going to do 8 million tons of pellets a year, what's that? 14 trillion gallons of water plus. Where does the water come from? How much of that water will be recycled? If there's waste that goes out, at what standard is the wastewater going to come out of that plant? Will it be the drinking water standard? How much water will be have to be replenished every year to keep the water in the system for producing the pellets? That's all proprietary information. We're getting from the company nothing but misinformation and proprietary information. Rather than sit down with tribal government, sit down with the people that live in northern Wisconsin and talk about the issues and get the questions on the table, they've run here to southern legislators and say, well, here's what we have for you. We've got a bunch of jobs. You got a governor that says Wisconsin is open for business. Well, that's quickly translated as Wisconsin's for sale. Well, geez, Scott Walker, if you're going to sell it, at least sell it to the highest bidder. Let's have a process. But he's hell-bent to turn northern Wisconsin into a third-world country and say, wow, you know, northern Wisconsin has these minerals. We need these minerals to keep Milwaukee going. We need these minerals to keep Madison running, to take care of southern Wisconsin. And, you know, at last glance, I look at the employment down here for kids running through the cities, punching people out on at the state fair and things like that. I'm saying, no, you guys aren't taking care of business down here either. So what are you doing? How have you demonstrated to us that you're responsible here to come up north and tell us what's good for us? That's not making any sense. It certainly isn't good government. Here we have maybe one legislature, one legislator, Bob Jouk, in the Senate. We got Nick Milroy, Janet Bealey, a couple other people in the Assembly. So they kind of end up standing in the middle of the road with the big buses running at them, because the people here will look to, the Democrats are looking to Jouk, from what I'm gleaning, for some direction. And I think Bob's put in a position where he's going to have to start trying to negotiate something with these companies and with these out-of-control Republicans, and same goes for the out-of-control Democrats, to see what they can sell to northern Wisconsin. That's a train wreck written to happen, because this whole dialogue we're having comes down to, well, let's get a bipartisan committee together to come up and meet with the people in northern Wisconsin so we can get some idea of what should be in a law. Well, first of all, why would anyone sit down with a bipartisan committee that's coming out of Madison? There is no bipartisanship down here. It's just foolishness. Secondly, we have good laws. Spencer Black, Russ Decker, Harvey Stauer, and others negotiated and put in some good, solid laws in the state of Wisconsin that protect our water resources. Listen to public radio this morning driving in here. There's no water in Texas. The rivers are dry. Those people don't have water to drink. And we're willing to listen to people from down in this part of the state saying, well, we can waste this water. Not at all. Not an ounce of water should be wasted on any industrial development. Now, I think there are people up north that may disagree with what I'm going to say now, is that if you are thirsty, we'll share that water. If it's going to go to people that need water to maintain life, we can share the water. And that's a pretty generous offer, because no one's ever shared the gold or the silver or any of the wealth with us. All we've ever been offered are the scraps that are left on the table. But we like it that way, because for the most part, it's a very beautiful place to live. And for the most part, we have struggles. But there are homeless people sleeping on the steps of the Capitol at night. There are people that are looking for work, looking for homeless shelters. There are single moms crying for help down here also, and none of those needs have been met. And those needs weren't met when the economy was flying high. So we're not really concerned about people. We're concerned about industry, and we're concerned about tax system, and we're concerned about the corporations making a profit. And, of course, the way Walker and these people are allowing the state to be run, they're hoping to have a collision course between union labor and people who want to keep clean water. And one of the things that we're doing this week, the Water's Edge is doing, as we went over to the Labor Temple, passed out cards, visited with the labor leaders, and said, let's sit down and have a conversation. Let's preempt what's going to happen in Wisconsin, and let's sit down and put it on the table and have an honest conversation to say what can we agree on and what can't we agree on. Because right now, labor needs everyone's support they can get. We need to support labor and labor unions, because if we don't have the unions, and there are good, bad, indifferent unions, and good, bad, indifferent union people, but if we don't have the unions, it'll be 6-7 days a week work for everybody. I mean, unions set the standard for a civilized society. And that leads us to some policy that's reasonable, so that the unions are powerful. And to see them stripped and brought to their knees by the foolishness in the Capitol is really sad. On the other hand, to have been over there yesterday and see about 1,000 people show up, standing strong and getting prepared to come back when the legislature opens up, that's awesome. And if we stand together, we're going to win. But we'll stand with anybody that will help us take care of the water, will help us take care of our economy so we can provide the services that we need for disabled people, for kids, for the vets, for all these programs that are vital to civilized society. Right now, none of that's going to happen in the state of Wisconsin, because it's just a collision waiting to happen. And we're just seeing, I think, the tip of the iceberg of the anger and the frustration of, you know, at the Capitol. And I told one of the representative's assistants, I said, I really don't mean this the way it sounds, but you are going to have public hearings up north on this mine. And they'll either be on the highway with people with baseball bats and pitchforks standing there stopping trucks saying, we are going to have a public hearing, or you're going to send the full committee up. But don't be disrespectful and send up half a committee. And even though the politicians down here aren't, for the most part, interested in our goodwill, Union Cab is, they said, you get to Madison, we'll provide transportation to the Capitol. They're working on finding places for people to stay, for food. I mean, it's just an outpouring of the people from the city of Madison saying, how can we help you? The university has at least one, if not two, student groups that are forming to help us strategize on how we can address this economy, how we can address the laws, how we can look at the labor market and say, how do we do things differently? Let's end this meaningless discussion that's going on as to which one of the bullies in the big playground across the street in the state house is in charge of the playground. And let's get some peace and justice people in to sit down and discuss some issues.
with the mines going on, and I know there's a lack of jobs up north and people are struggling, especially Native American people, how would the mine coming in affect them? It's water, environment, job? I mean, are we talking about something that will help? What are we talking?
Well, the only thing we can look at is what's happened in third world nations, what's happened out in the Dakotas, what's happened in northern Minnesota, what's going on in northern Michigan, what's going on surrounding Lake Superior right now with all kinds of mining activity, is to say what's been the long-term effect. If we look at Hurley and we look at the heyday of the mining, it was a boom or bust economy. It boomed, it busted, what's left behind? We do the same thing in Minnesota. So how does it affect the local economy? I'm sure there's going to put some jobs in. Are there going to be local jobs? I tend to doubt that. The mining is highly mechanized. And the equipment that will come in will be not locally produced up north. It'll be brought in. The companies will hire experienced miners. I haven't received the brochure, but I'm told that there was an ad in the paper down in the southwest someplace that said miners, mining tech, what is it, technologists, I think, needed in northern Wisconsin. So we don't see training programs. They're not going to provide training programs for things that might last 10, 15 years, maybe 30 years. My sense of this is that they're going to come in, and it will be the initial, if they're successful, the initial clearing of the Pinoki Hills, the removal of the topsoil in the trees, will probably be so devastating that everyone will be up in arms to say this can't go on any longer. My sense from the company is, and it is only my sense, that they would love to see some kind of mining regulations passed that are less than, are much different than what we have. Get the permits, sit back and say, okay, now we got the permits for the next 100 years, we can do what we want. That's not acceptable.
Well, they've already come out and said that they're not going to compete with the mines in Minnesota that's been going for 30 years. They're going to actually come in and do it cheaper than the mines in Minnesota.
Well, I think if they come in and do it cheaper than the mines in Minnesota, more power to them. They're running the mines in Minnesota pretty cheaply now. They're producing twice the taconite pellets, probably with half the labor, the historical attempts. If they come into northern Wisconsin, the technology that they'll use will be one step beyond that. So I don't know. You know, the employment figures we look at, they're all over the place. One time you hear we're going to have 2,800 spin-off jobs. Well, what are the spin-off jobs? Well, you know, the answer is, well, you know what that is. Well, no, I don't know what it is. Is it more taverns? Is it more bars? Is it more one-stops? What are the spin-off businesses? To the numbers of people that will be employed in the mine, these open pit mines that are 4 miles long, and the way the rock is, or the way the ore that they're after is in the ground, they will be long strip mines. And I have no sense of their employment numbers. I know that I can't believe their figures, and I don't think most other people believe them, because they're all over the place. And at one time we hear it's millions of dollars and money will stay in the communities. Well, none of that was put in the legislation. You know, these guys didn't think about putting one sentence in this 183 pages of how money was going to be how it was going to be kept in northern Wisconsin. What are the long-term investments they're going to make? What's their commitment to cleanup? Are we going to end up like other states that, well, after 20 years, they get a a slip that says you've successfully closed the mine and they walk away. We haven't had that success in Flambeau. I think Roscoe Churchill, the mining activist over there who passed away a few years ago and wrote a book called The Buzzards Have Landed, which is a study of the Flambeau mine. One of the last pictures of him is standing there at the area that was reclaimed, and he just said, it's grass over grave. And it seems that the effluent is now leaking into the Flambeau River. We'll have the same situation up here. What's at stake with the wild rice beds? It could devastate them. The company was very, very specific about there's no sulfide rock. There's absolutely no sulfide rock up there. And 2 months ago, a month ago, they contacted a firm in Green Bay that mitigates sulfide. And there is sulfide rock up there. Now, how much sulfide rock there is, we don't know. And we're not going to find out because that's proprietary. Well, I don't know how these people come into my backyard and tell me it's proprietary. I think we need to tell them that it's proprietary. It doesn't make a lot of sense to us.
With the destruction of the wild rice, how important is that to the native communities? I mean, you know, you already talked about how important it was to the ecosystem, but how important is that to some of the economic
Yeah, it would be good to talk to people up in Bad River, you know, Chairman Mike Wiggins and Vice Chairman Bing Lemieux, to talk about the cultural significance of what rice is and how the Ojibwe ended up living in northern Wisconsin with their migrations and found the rice. And that was through some prophecies that I'm certainly not the person to talk about. But right now, the rice is a cultural food. And I think this year, the rice harvest is exemplary from what I'm hearing. And that rice is sold, the rice is given away, it becomes a real backbone of the food economy on a reservation and probably in other parts of northern Wisconsin. And those rice beds support the fish, they support the plants. These are important plants, and the Pinokis are filled with, you know, these plant beings that are medicine plants and others that are integral to what keeps this ecosystem alive and healthy. And we start scraping away the topsoil and we start having runoff, that'll be profound.
So we're talking not only about an environmental destruction, but a cultural destruction as well.
We're talking about cultural destruction, absolutely. And there's a few of us that look at this and say, if this was Cudahy, we might not be having this conversation right now. But because it's northern Wisconsin, sparsely populated, and the population that would be affected the most would be the Bad River Ojibwe, one has to raise the question of environmental racism and say, what's fair here? This is just not a good idea. And there are people that get very chagrined when you use those kind of terms. Well, rather than get chagrined, I'd rather have them have a discussion about why isn't it? Because it's on the table. And when we have all of these kinds of things that are sort of the non-discussables going through a government system and people get on their high horse and say, well, we're not going to discuss those things, and sure as hell are, because those are important questions. How are the brothers and sisters treated? And is it because they're people of color, or is it because somebody down here has defined poverty as not having enough money or having a bunch of junk in your yard or four-story houses? What is, you know, part of this discussion needs to be, who are the real poor people in our society? Those of us that have an artesian well in our backyard to go out and get a good drink of water and listen to the chickens and plant a garden and watch the sunrise and the sunset and not have to listen to cars and smell polluted air. I think maybe that's a sign of wealth. And I don't know of anyone in northern Wisconsin who has come down here to buy a second home for a vacation. I just haven't found anybody that's done that. Yeah, I'm sure there's some around, but we haven't found anybody. But they sure flock north. You go to any city. Anybody that lives here needs to go sit 5 miles out of any city south of Wausau on Saturday or Friday night and look, which way is the traffic going? And take a look on Sunday, Monday morning. Which way is the traffic going? We got something going on up there that's really working well. And maybe what we have to do is start saying, you're not going to come up there and have $8 fish fries anymore. It's going to cost you $15 for a fish fry because what we have is going to cost you. And it's not going to be a cheap place to go and have your vacations. You're going to have to pay your fair share.
Well, how can we come and help you? What can we do to help
well,
the water's edge?
What you can save the water's edge is that we need at least however many Democrats are in the Senate, and we need about four or five other Republicans to say, no, Wisconsin has good mining laws. And if a company is going to come into this state and say, we want to open up a mine, and we'll open up a mine following Wisconsin's good mining laws, even though they're strict and stringent, but we're going to follow those. We can sit down and talk to them. But when a company comes into the state of Wisconsin and makes a mockery out of these people across the street at the state house, when they tell us up north, we'll follow all these laws, and then we come down here and everybody's trying to figure out how to change them. We need to have your help in calling up the legislative, whoever your legislator is, and say, vote no on any changes in our mining laws. If there are specific issues that need to be addressed, let the company come into the rotunda at the Capitol or go to Packer Stadium and address the state of Wisconsin and say, these are the three reasons why we can't open up a mine, and these are the things that need to be changed, and explain to us why they need to be changed. Because what they've done now is they've taken eminent domain, mining companies are in charge. Throwing out all the water regulations, mining companies are in charge. If there's a dispute between local government, local citizens, and a mining company, the legislation was going to read the mining company trumps. How the hell does that kind of legislation even get considered? By the mere fact that people would sit down and write that stuff as a proposal is asinine. And to have people that will sit, that we elect, that listen to that and not take those guys out and throw them underneath the bus right from the get-go, it just befuddles my mind. So it's vote no. It's absolutely vote no on any changes in our mining laws. There is no reason why any of these laws need to be changed that have been articulated by anyone other than a bunch of hand-wringing people over there saying, well, we got to do something. Well, what do we have to do? All of a sudden, we have to do something about jobs. All of a sudden, we have to do something about schools. All of a sudden, we have to do something about welfare. All of a sudden, we got to go out to all our employees at work and say, we got to take your money away from you. All of a sudden, this comes up because a mining company comes into Wisconsin with a big bunch of cash and filters it around our legislative system. I don't think so. You know, it doesn't make sense to me. And I would like to see us make these guys that we elected do a job and represent the people of Wisconsin and represent us fairly and honestly and look at our progressive tradition of good government. And when they tell me that certain legislators go in and scream jobs, 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 stand up to those bullies. Tell them to sit down and shut up. We're going to talk about clean water.
On that note, I'd like to thank Frank Kane for being on today. He is with the Water's Edge and the Pinocchi Hills Education Project. Their website is www.savethewatersedge.com. Thank you for being on today.
Well, thank you. This was a nice time.
And again, that was Frank Kane from Save the Water's Edge. It's savethewatersedge.com. Now, I have a caller. She brought up some really good questions I don't have any answers to, but I thought the questions were really good to pose because I think these are things people need to be thinking about. So let me get her on. Hello, caller. What were those the questions you were telling me about? Give me some of those questions. So they were really good questions that people need to think about when we talk about the mine.
All right. My question is, it seems there is an assumption as to which mining company would come in to do the mine. It seems like there was a selection based on profit, not necessarily concern for their environmental integrity. As far as the research I've done, these clients, environmental managers, from what I read, made a statement that if they had to follow environmental regulations, they would never make a profit. And as well as the science tech that's assigned, and this may be incorrect information, but as far as I've been researching, his name is Bill Williams, and Bill Williams is responsible for one of the 10 worst environmental atrocities in Spain of around 2000, where they dumped a load of tailings, so much of it, that it literally caused a sludge that broke through an enormous dam and contaminated a wildlife reserve in Spain the size of the Yosemite Park. So how did these people with such a poor track record ever even begin to get considered for touching the gold in our or even the gold environment, I call our trees and our wildlife, our gold. So how could they even come in and be considered for that? And the other questions I've had, too, this proprietary type of information in terms of the amount of water that is being withdrawn from for this mine is going to have an effect on the Great Lakes. And I've been attending the DNR meetings for the diversion request for Waukesha from Lake Michigan, and I hear that anything, and I've read with the Great Lakes Complex, that any kind of large quantity of water withdrawal requires a citizen hearing in regard to respect with the Great Lakes Compact. Now, I'm wondering, is Walker trying to wait until they change the Great Lakes Compact that allows citizens to make a comment about it? Or are the other question is, are they actually giving away this not giving away the information about the water withdrawal with the mines in order to avoid a conflict with the Great Lakes Compact? So that is the hidden information that I think makes a crucial condition in terms of who is either not or is given the mining company's work.
I'm going to cut you there real fast because I'll tell you what I know about the water. Now, that's going to probably change, but as of right now, the mining company has actually said they're going to use the chlorinated water from Mellon. Mellon is a groundwater source, so they're bypassing the Great Lakes Compact because the water they're getting is not coming from the Great Lakes as of right now. It's coming from the town of Mellon. The question is, with Mellon, how big is the town? How deep are the wells? How much water do they have? And do we want to put chlorinated water back into the system? Hold on a second because I'm not hearing you fully and I don't know if other people are. So give a second here. All right. She just dropped off, so she'll call back in a minute, I'm sure. But there is more questions. Well, before she calls back, I want to let you know, too, about Chris Klein. Now, it's Chris Klein that has the mining company that's going to be going and that's applying to get the Pinocchi Mountain Range mine. I believe it's called Gogo. I can't remember the name of it right now. But it's two words, and one of them's taconite. And there she is. I'll get her on in just a second. But he also has mines across the country, and one of which is in Illinois. Now, there is a group in Illinois that's trying to shut down the coal mine he has out there, because with the coal mine, he's promised these great things. He's come out and he's actually said, well, there's going to be all these jobs, and we're going to be bringing in millions of dollars in taxes, and you guys are going to be great, and you know, we have this mine, and we're going to bring in these jobs, and you know, a lot of the same stuff that they've been saying up here. And in southern Illinois, middle Illinois, southern Illinois, they're pretty hard hit as well. Unlike northern Wisconsin has somewhat of a tourist thing, southern Illinois and middle Illinois is pretty flat. There's not much going on there. So when these get really hard hit with recession, there's not much they can do. So this town actually, I believe, gave the land to Chris Klein's coal mining company that he set up down there. So what they could do is, that way the town was thinking, oh, we're going to get all these millions of dollars. We can put money back into the schools. We're really going to need to do well. Well, as of last year, the millions of dollars coming in has turned into $100,000 for the year because they're behind schedule. And they don't have a lot of jobs. So now this small town that they're, and I know it's a coal, it's a little different, it's doing coal, but this small town is now still struggling because they don't have that money that is expected to come in. They're going to have to lay off teachers. They're going to have to start looking at different things they can do to try to keep the town just going. And they're extracting coal. There's no profit coming in, and you're doing it under farmland, which is causing some problems with the farmland. So you have a group of farmers down in middle to southern Illinois who are fighting this coal mine that Chris Klein is doing down there. With that being said, I'm going to bring the caller back on. Hello, caller. Welcome back.
Hi, thank you. I'm calling to thank you for elaborating on Chris Klein's history. He does not have a good track record, and neither does Bill Williams have a good track record. It's difficult to follow what he's done, but some people have been able to find, you know, some more information via the internet of what he's actually responsible for. So there needs to be concern, I think, overall by Wisconsin, by not assuming that, you know, should even a mine go through, that this should be the company that does it. They have not demonstrated integrity with their environmental laws and even have professed not to be able to profit if they did. The other thing, too, I'm concerned about is with the Great Lakes diversion, the compact diversion of water for Waukesha, I just started, you know, attending some of the DNR hearings as well as at the very same time working up and learning more about the mine situation in northern Wisconsin. And suddenly, there were two senators in responsibility for both. And it's Mark Honondale and Rich Zipperer are both responsible for signing, and I'm not sure if they wrote it, a bill that is being submitted for the northern Wisconsin mine, at least the last one, whether they're going to be doing this next one, I'm not sure. But they're the ones taking responsibility for that mine, as well as when I went to the DNR hearings for the Waukesha withdrawal, all of a sudden I learned that it was Rich Zipper's district, Waukesha, that was asking for water from Mark Honondale's district in Oak Creek. And suddenly there's another violation of the Great Lakes Compact that needed to be addressed, and they're looking for large amounts of water. And, in fact, the justifications were through the hearings that they were asking for more water than rationally was necessary for the city. They were actually basing it on exponential increases from a growing community in 1998 when it's actually shrunk in size. And so there's some real other issues, too, that have come up where the city council has actually denied a referendum vote by citizens in terms of making a statement whether they would like to have the diversion or not. So citizens, again, with Honondale and Rich Zipper, are being disallowed to make a personal comment or references to what they think, as well as crossing out all citizen input on the bill that was submitted for the mines. They literally have a line in the bill that was written crossing out every single sentence that states anything about citizens having the ability to have a voice in how this mine is executed or performed. Those are the three things that I'm really worried about. I don't understand how such a, you know, even if you hired a teacher with a track record that created an explosion through a school and destroyed it permanently so no one could go to that, you know, land anymore, you know, would not be hired again. You know, I can't see how Walker, with all his condemnations of bad teachers in the state, would hire somebody with a record that has one of the top worst environmental atrocities in the world, equivalent to Fukushima. I'm serious. It is just to have to go look it up on the internet. So it is, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for bringing those questions up. And I suggest that people go and look these things up and see what's going on, what's out there. It wouldn't surprise me. I personally don't know, as I don't know some of the people that are involved with it. But I do know that it wouldn't surprise me if that's something that was done to be bringing people in. And the name of that LLC that's up with the mine is Gogobek Taconite. So thank you, guys. Another thing that the caller was talking about was the water going on in Waukesha right now, and I've been following that as well, and I know we've got some Waukesha people listening, so maybe they can fill in a little bit on some of the water issues. But it's interesting that you have Zipperer, who's working with the mine or putting his name on the mine, who's not even in northern Wisconsin, and is also doing the same thing, working with the Great Lakes Compact down in Waukesha, in that area. So very interesting that we've got some correlations, and it's coming back to some of the water issues. Now I'm going to go ahead and get Chris Liebenthal on. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
Good morning. Chris Liebenthal.
Good morning.
I'm good. How are
good
you?
I'm pretty good, too. Thank you.
Awesome. Chris is the wonderful blogger, Cognitive Dissident. And if you have any questions for Chris, we're going to be talking about Scott Walker and some of the stuff he's done. And some new information just came out last night. But the phone number to ask Chris any questions is 310-742-1896 or toll-free at 877-497-1797. Now we're going to start. There is a furlong story that you've been following. Kid, before you get the new information that came out with that, can you give a synopsis of the story of how it's unfolded up to this point?
All right. Well, for the last several years of Scott Walker's tenure as Milwaukee County Executive, he did, as he's trying to do now, and balance the books on the backs of the workers. In doing so, he initially tried to do an indefinite work reduction week where workers were going to be denied 5 hours of pay each week. This was grieved by the unions, and they had won in arbitration that he could only do it for 35 hours a week. Well, Scott Walker tried to do an end around by not doing work reduction weeks, but by adding furloughs, adding up to 26 days of furloughs per year for some workers, not all of them, but just some of them, all union members. This, again, was grieved by the unions going through arbitration process, through complaints to the Wisconsin Employment Relations Committee. And long story short, it was found that, you know, Walker had exceeded his authority once again by issuing so many furlough days. And the county was told that they needed to reimburse the workers for doing this. Walker appealed the arbitration ruling to a circuit court judge who was favorable to Walker and ruled that, no, he did have the right to issue these furlough days. The county unions filed an appeal in appellate court, which was heard by Justice Ralph Adam Klein, who overturned the circuit courts and ruled that, according to Wisconsin state law, when both parties agree to arbitration, the arbitrator's ruling is final, and the courts don't have a authority to overturn any rulings unless there was proof of some sort of malfeasance or corruption involving the arbitrator. Now, for the big news that I've just recently learned was that the county had appealed this to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has ruled that they're not going to hear the case, which means that Justice Fine's ruling, that the arbitration ruling stands, is in effect. That translates into practical terms that the county will owe several thousand county workers back pay for anything in excess of 35 hours of furloughs. That comes out to be around $6 or $7 million, plus 12% interest compounded daily.
So it's basically another way to try to bankrupt Milwaukee then.
Well, that's going to be the end result. Basically what it was is that Walker, as county executive, just had declared, he would declare a fiscal emergency on January 1st of the year and say the only way that we could balance the books was by balancing it on the backs of the workers. And so he exceeded his authority in doing that. And now that he's governor, he's stuck Milwaukee County with the bill for his political grandstanding.
And how many times has he actually stuck Milwaukee County with bills?
Numerous times. Between something like this furlough, where he exceeded his authority, to playing budgetary games, waiting one fund to cover budget holes in another area, to not filling fully funded positions in order to use that money for some other purpose than what it was intended to. For example, with the income maintenance program, which is commonly known, with the food stamps and W-2 and energy assistance and those sorts of programs, the call center was fully funded by the county board to have a full staff of 30 people. However, Walker would often have only 5 to 10 people working in the call center at any time, and that was just not enough people to handle the influx of calls, especially when the recession hit. Because of that, a class action lawsuit was filed against the state and the county of Milwaukee. And it resulted, it could have resulted in a multi-million-dollar ruling against the county and the state. In order to avoid that, the state took action and took over that department from Milwaukee County a couple of years ago while Walker was still county executive. Another way of saying it, he had the money to fill the spots to avoid this trouble. He chose not to fill those spots, use the money for Lord knows what else, privatization contracts or other budget holes that he put into place. And that resulted in the county not being able to do its job the way it's required to do it.
Was the money actually used? The money he set aside for that, was it actually used for something else, or was it just used and no one knows where it went, or is it still sitting in there for the jobs?
No, it was used for something else. The money, basically he was continuously short funding his own county as county executive. And to fill the gaps in the holes, to make it look like he had a balanced budget, he would just not fill positions and plan that money to be a savings. Ironically, every year we would end up having some kind of surplus, and he would say that was because of his fiscal frugality, when all it was is actually he was not doing his job.
So going back to statewide now, in the voter ID bill, and we'll touch on this a little bit later with the whole Chris Larson issue, but the voter ID bill, they actually have money set aside for free IDs. They put it in the bill. Do you think that he learned some of that tricks from being county executive, so the money is there, but he actually can pull it to use for different things?
Yeah, well, that's what I believe is happening, that he, you know, the budget has so much money set aside to provide free voter IDs to try to keep the law legal and make it pass any kind of court challenge by various groups. However, I don't think it was ever his administration's intention to actually use that money. And so you had that memo that came out saying you're not supposed to use that money. You know, you're not supposed to tell people about it. If they ask for it, fine, but you're not to volunteer the information. I think that was just mainly a way for him wanting to try to save that money to fill budget gaps in other areas.
Now, I have a question from the chat room. It's from Brian. He asked, how has Walker's appointee, train wreck of incompetence and ideology, Dennis Smith, DHS head, also hurt Milwaukee?
Well, first of all, Walker's appointee has refused to pursue a federal grant for, you know, medical programs that would help the poor people in Milwaukee County. You know, with the policy towards senior care and family care, they're putting a cap on family care, keeps almost 1,000 disabled people from receiving services in Milwaukee County. And the ironic part of it was while Walker was campaigning for governor, he used family care as one of his talking points about how wonderful it was and, you know, what a great program that it was and how he was helping the people in Milwaukee through that program, even though it was already ordered by Governor Jim Doyle from Milwaukee County to transition into family care. And as soon as he's governor, well, the program's, you know, yeah, it's fine, but we're not going to pay any more into it. So he did a complete 180 on family care and his support for disabled people. Yeah, also, you know, Mr. Smith has got a long history before coming to Wisconsin of being opposed to senior care, which is a widely popular program among Wisconsin seniors, especially in Milwaukee, where we have a large population. It saves both the state and the voters' money. So why he was against that, I don't understand, unless it's to be beholden to the special interests.
There's a lot of things that our governor has done that I don't understand.
You're not the only one in that realm.
Well, and Brian also said, I believe he's talking about Walker again. He said he also pulled money from the public election fund, funded by taxpayers checking off a box on their state returns for the state to keep a dollar of their refund. And he also says $8 million dollars of lost declined grants to health programs that doesn't include the cuts to Badger Care Senior Care.
Well, that's one of the first things that they did in the beginning was to consolidate all those services and the rules around them into Walker's administration, effectively bypassing the legislature in case that it would return to Democratic hands or into at least more reasonable hands. He would have the right to just exercise his will as he wanted, not having to worry about getting approval because that was the county board was a major thorn in his side as county executive. It's the county board that kept Milwaukee County from becoming even worse than it already is, by preventing Scott Walker from doing a lot of the things that he would have done.
And he has the support of the legislature now, so he can go and do all the things he wanted to do. I have, I'm sorry, I'll let you answer that, and then I'll go. So.
Well, basically, yeah, he, you know, and he took advantage of that, and that's why we saw things ramrodded through right away. He knew that these things weren't going to be popular because basically they're unethical. It's not wise government to have so much control in the hands of just one person. It goes against the checks and balances that the state and the country was built on. And he wanted to get this done right away before, while he had everything on his side that would allow him to do this. It's going to take a lot of work and a long time to correct all the things that have happened over the years under Walker's administration.
I'm going to put you on hold. I'm not going to put you on hold, but I'm going to let you listen in as I pick up another call, because I think, is this Chris on here?
Yes, this is Chris.
Okay. We have Chris Larson on the phone with us, our local hero, who was brave enough to send out an email and end up getting fired for it. Welcome to the show, Chris. Thanks for calling in today.
Thanks for having me.
So while you're here, I want you to tell your story. I know some people were able to catch it on Sly, but out in this area where I'm at, especially in southeast Wisconsin, I know some of the northern people are listening as well, they may not be able to hear what actually occurred. So can you tell your story on what happened?
Okay. All I know is I was on my way to work, and I was listening to Sly in the morning on Thursday morning, and I heard him talking about the DMV ordering people not to inform people of the free ID. And if they don't, if they're not informed that it's free and they get it, they would still have to pay for it. And that didn't seem right to me. So when I got to work, I get to work usually before mostly everybody else. And so about 6:45, I sent out an email to all of my coworkers in the building that I work in. And I was just informing them what I had heard, just the fact that I heard them on the show earlier, just a little while ago. So all I said in the email was, I was just keeping them informed, just letting them know, hey, you're able to get a free ID to vote with if you do not have an ID to vote with, but you need to ask, because if you do not ask, you will be charged. That's pretty much all the email said. It was not biased one way or another. It wasn't saying that the government's trying to rob anybody or anything, just letting people, just keep people informed is all I was doing. And then about 8:30, my supervisor walked into my office and pulled me out of my office, and we went to her supervisor's office, and they said that it was an inappropriate email to send via work email, and that Secretary Dave Ross would be very unhappy once he sees the email, and they thought it would be best if we parted ways.
Wow.
That's pretty much the gist of it.
So basically, because the law says it's free, and I was just telling Chris Liebenthal, Cognitive Dissonance, that they have money set aside for free. So all you were doing is telling them what the law was really saying.
Yes.
And that was it. That within 2 hours of sending out that email, you were gone.
Yes, exactly. I don't know. I think it's pretty crazy that it's, this big deal, I guess. But I didn't realize what I was jumping into when I sent the email. I don't know. I was just trying to keep people informed, and, maybe they could pass the message along. Not everybody reads the paper, not everybody sees the news. And actually, when I sent the email, I didn't know that this was actually on the news the night before. So, I don't know. It's really weird. It's like it's okay for the media to tell people, but, don't let a person tell other people, I guess. I don't know. It just seems kind of wrong.
It does. It really does. Do you have any updates at all? Are you getting any help from anyone? Is there any kind of outpouring to help you with get your job back? And if you got your job back, if they offered it, would you take it back?
See, I'm not sure. I know I have a meeting this week at some point. and we're going to maybe see if we can iron things out a little bit. I've also been told, I've also talked to a lawyer, and he is looking into it to see if anything can be done, too. So that's about all I could say at the moment.
Well, I tell you what, if you need anything, you let me know, and I'll help you out, because anyone who has the courage to stand up and say, this is what's right, deserves to have the help that they get. So you don't deserve to have your lose your job. You deserve to be, I mean, they should actually put you as an exemplary employee.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't believe I should have gotten fired. I don't know if I should be like some kind of outstanding employee either. I was just doing my duty as a fellow citizen of the state to just keep the message going and keep people informed.
Well, I think you should be I think that they should at least, if nothing else, you should have lost your job, that's for sure. But I think standing up and saying something and doing what's right says something about who you are. And I wish more people would do that. So good luck.
A lot more people should spread a lot more. They shouldn't just sit down. And I can't imagine that my place of employment expected to blow up like this either, but I wasn't just going to be, oh, they fired me, okay, I'll move on. No, I wasn't. That was not my thought at all. I'm not just going to lay down because I got fired.
You are an amazing person. Thank you so much for being on. If you need anything, I've got a Facebook page or my email, sarahschultzshow@gmail.com. Email me, and we'll see what we can do. I'll see what I can do to help you out.
Okay. Well, thank you.
So, you're welcome. Good luck, and maybe you could call back in a week or two and let us know how things are going see if anything new has come up.
As things go along, I'll definitely keep people informed, people that I've talked to in the last 2 days. I'll keep everybody informed.
Well, thank you so much for being on, Chris. Have a great day now.
You too. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. All right. Bye.
Bye.
Well, the other Chris we have on is the Chris and Chris show for a moment. How does that play into things that Walker has done before? I mean, obviously, this is just one more behavior pattern that he's done.
Well, yeah, this is at least the third example that I've heard of that he's basically tried to intimidate people that would speak out against him or speak out against his policies. There was, of course, the story of myself, one of his allied groups, Citizens for Responsible Government, had gone as far as filing a criminal complaint against me based on false information, accusing me of doing my blogging on county time or on the county equipment, in an effort to shut me up, basically. Also, more recently, this past year, there was the Wisconsin Republican Party going after Professor Cronin for a piece he wrote about Alec, the extreme right-wing front group for big money people like the Koch brothers, who basically are writing all these state policies that our state government has recently enacted, which are, heavily favored businesses and are totally against the working class, against unions, against government employees, and basically just trying to consolidate power and money further into the hands of the ultra-rich conservatives. So, Walker's got a long history of using people to go after other people that would dare to speak out about him or resist his resists his agenda in any form. Speaking of Mr. Larson, something else that came across my attention just this morning was that both the person that fired him and the person that
made a vague statement that Mr. Larson was allegedly having a long work history of problems are both known GOP operatives that had gotten their positions after Walker was elected as governor.
So they're some of Walker's cronies then?
Right. You know, and that's another thing that's very common among with Walker, and if you follow his history, is that anybody that works for him, his campaign, or helps him out in any way, tends to get paid back in favors by getting cushy state jobs. He did that as county executive, where he appointed various campaign staffers to high-level county jobs, whether or not they were qualified for it. And we're seeing that on the state level. You know, one of his campaign people that was handling his social media stuff had gotten a job with the state, as well as various members that he worked with in Milwaukee County, including Tyner Deli and Cindy Archer. So he's, you know, he doesn't even really bother to try to hide the cronyism anymore. There's also the famous case of Brian DeShane, who was, you know, the son of a, his only qualification for a job in the state was that he was the son of a wealthy lobbyist who had donated a lot of money to Walker's campaign. And he was appointed to some high-level state positions, even though he was not qualified. He never graduated from school. He had a couple of drunk driving arrests, apparently. And they passed up a number of people that were qualified that wanted the job in order to give it to this lobbyist son. It's just very blatant, and that's what has actually kind of initiated the whole John Doe investigation into his campaign.
I was just going to say, let's go into the John Doe investigation. Now, can you explain to people what the John Doe investigation is?
Well, you know, I might not be expressing it in perfect legal terms because I'm not a lawyer and I don't pretend to be one on TV or on the Internet. But basically, a John Doe investigation is a investigation into possible wrongdoing, usually of high public figures, or, you know, noticeably public figures, of possible wrongdoing that may or may not lead to indictments. In this case, the John Doe investigation was into Scott Walker's campaign with basically a two-prong approach. One was one of the paths has already been settled, and that's regarding the railroad engineer whose name escapes me, the owner of a railroad company, that had illegally funneled money from his company through his employees into the Walker campaign. The man that did this readily admitted he did it, but had apologized, and is now currently serving a rather slap on the wrist type of sentence. And the Walker's campaign had immediately returned that money when it came to public attention. The other path that the John Doe investigation is going down involves possible illegal campaigning by both county staff and by his campaign staff, from what I understand. Now, being a John Doe, there's not a lot out there that can be confirmed directly. A lot of this is hearsay or, you know, various things that might be picked up. For example, to go back, it started with a year and a half ago when Darlene Wink, who was his Walker's director of constituent affairs from Milwaukee County, was caught leaving comments on JS Online, the Milwaukee Journal's website,
supporting Walker's campaign during county, during the time she was supposed to be working. That led for a call for an investigation by the county supervisor, John Weishaupt, into what everybody else was doing at the time. And also, shortly thereafter, another longtime Walker crony and county employee, Tim Russell, had been videotaped by the Democrats when Walker went for his alleged tourism bike ride last year. He had this Tim Russell going along doing basically campaign work, apparently while he was getting paid by the county. And, there was investigations into Mr. Russell to the point where they went into his office and confiscated his computer, his BlackBerry, opened up locked files, and took out a bunch of information and documents or whatever else for their investigation. It's my understanding that they could both be facing serious charges. We do know that for a fact that they have both lawyered up pretty well, as well as did Walker's campaign itself. They hired former U.S. Attorney Steve Skubik to defend themselves. They've paid a conservative law firm $60,000 to quote unquote ensure campaign compliance. Well, that's a lot of money just to make sure your I's are dotted and T's are crossed. So a lot of people believe that this might be a sign that they were responding to some John Doe, something from the John Doe investigation. I'm aware that subpoenas have been still going out as recently as the last couple of months, although I'm not sure to who in regard to the investigation, but anybody that's had anything to do with it is just saying that, this thing is going to be very big when it does come out.
And do you think, I know this is around Tim Russell and the campaign, but because it was Walker's campaign, is this something that's actually going to go directly to Walker, or is it just going to, again, float around Walker and not actually touch him?
Well, see, that's something I can't speak to because I'm not privy to all that information, obviously. However, I've seen statements in Journal Sentinel stories and other stories where Walker is quickly backpedaling from anything to do with the investigation, trying to distance himself as much as possible. In my own mind, say, for example, that they do indict Tim Russell or Darlene Wink or any of his other people for doing illegal campaigning. My first question would be, what did Walker know and when did he know it? Walker's got a long history of campaign violations. In fact, he received one of the largest fines in state history for a campaign violation when he was sending out robocalls without telling people that it was his campaign paying for it. And that was, the first time he ran for governor. And, he has a long history, even back to his college days, of playing fast and loose with campaign rules and basically doing whatever he wanted, and to hell with the consequences.
Well, it doesn't seem like much has changed.
He's always appeared to have and still has that attitude where he just wants to do what he wants, whether it's legal or not, whether it's ethical or not. he just wants what he wants, and he doesn't care who gets hurt in the process.
Well, we have about 50 seconds left, so why don't you tell people about your blog real fast and tell people how they can read it, what the website is.
Okay, well, I have a personal blog. It's called Cognitive Dissidence, not to be confused with dissonance. It's a free Blogspot site. It's if you just Google either my name, Chris Lieberthal, or if you Google Cognitive Dissidence, D-I-S-S-I-D-E-N-C-E, you'll find it pretty readily. Basically, it's just my personal viewpoints of what's going on both on the state and the local level. A lot of it is focused on Scott Walker because he's been just such a strong malevolent force in county history and now in state history. And just, you know, my own personal observations or things that I've heard or learned of regarding all this, a long history, of course, of the 8 months that he's been governor, the protests and all that. But I also go back for a couple of years before that when he was county executive and the damage he was doing to Milwaukee County. If people have that much time, they scroll back that far, they'll see a lot of things being repeated now that he's done in the last 8 years as county executive before he was elected governor. From campaign violations to budget shenanigans and chicanery, you know, pretending he has a balanced budget when he doesn't. He's left Milwaukee County with a $55 million hole this year and only making it worse by cutting off shared revenue. I've heard from people that looked at the state budget that the state budget could be as much as $500 million in the hole before it's done. Because of, you know, just the trickery and everything else when that comes out. It's going to be really bad, and he'll just use that as an excuse to, again, attack more, you know, public employees.
What's your Twitter account, Chris? Because I got to get going, but what's your Twitter account?
Okay. It's at CogDis, capital C-O-G underscore capital D-I-S. I'm also on Facebook under Chris Liebenthal.
Okay. So I will have you back on to talk more about Walker because I think it's important that people know where he was, what he did as exec, and where he's going to go with it because it seems like he just does the same thing over and over. So thanks, Chris, for being on, and have a good day.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks. That was Chris Liebenthal with Cognitive Dissidence. And he's a wonderful blogger. Follow him if you can. He's got a lot of great things to say, and he's really on top of Walker and what Walker's doing. Now, I'd like to introduce Yuri Rashkin. Is that correct? Did I say that right?
All right. Yes. Well, close enough. Yuri Rashkin. Yes.
All right. He is going to be doing our Defend Wisconsin weekly news roundup. So good afternoon, Yuri. What do you have for us this week?
Good afternoon, Sarah. Well, the week's been full of news, as it usually is, but it's been so jam-packed. It seems like Labor Day was a couple of months ago, but it was actually just last Monday. And, of course, here in, Janesville, where I'm headquartered, Paul Ryan and his appearance in Labor Day Parade was big, not only talk of the town, but we have several people come from outside, and he was well covered. His appearance was well covered. It was quite interesting. There's a lot of good footage out there that we highlighted, that others have highlighted, showing Paul, as always, pushing a stroller. It's pretty hilarious because I don't know if he's borrowing kids from someplace or what's going on, but it's a brand and an image thing, and he's always pushing his stroller in a Labor Day parade. Now, there was something interesting last year when he managed to take a kind of a shot at the Labor Day parade organizer, saying that since I'm a Republican, they, of course, put me in the back. And he obviously knows that every year Republicans and Democrats in the parade take turns, and this year he was out in front. but there was no political points, I guess, to score there, so he didn't say anything. Nonetheless, so Paul Ryan and Labor Day, of course, was a big deal, and there were Labor Day celebrations all across the state. And, of course, Paul continued with his limited appearances speaking to a Rotary Club in, let's see, what are they called? Whitnall Park Rotary Club, where there were at least 100 protesters and 75 supporters, and three people were arrested. Turned out, you know, he's having a really kind of a much harder time around this election cycle and in general this term than he's ever had. He was always treated with kid gloves. He was always looked at as a really nice guy with a great set of hair. And it turned out that apparently his policies are harming people, and we can no longer ignore that. So that's a really good, healthy thing. So besides Paul Ryan, there's been several interesting headlines, such as, of course, the governor being highlighted for his Another Pants on Fire statement, saying that the new tuition reimbursement deal with Minnesota has made tuition more affordable for Wisconsin residents. Turned out it's Pants on Fire wrong. Wisconsin yet again headlined the nation in being number one in cuts to education. This is out of 24 states, and that were measured, that information was provided for this paper, and it actually covers two-thirds of school-age population in this country. So having this strange recognition, I'd say rather unpleasant, of being number one in cuts to education, considering that Wisconsin was always known for its education, is really quite bad recognition. Now, additionally, there was a big, supposedly a big rally connected with neo-Nazis in West Allis. And from what I understand, reading the blogs out there, it's 25 people that were showed up, the so-called neo-Nazis, and there were at least 200 police officers in full riot gear, and somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 protesters who were protesting the neo-Nazis. So, as usual, it's the reaction that is bigger than the event itself.
And I heard
which
also,
is a good thing.
Oh, sorry to cut you out. I was going to say, I heard also that the 25 people were actually behind these barricades or these little fences, and the cops were all in riot gear and guarding the neo-Nazis.
Kind of reminiscent of those little freedom zones that were set up during Bush years. And but, you know, when you have people spewing hate in a free country, you know, on one hand, I suppose it's right to allow them to do that. On the other hand, something, you know, the fact that there's, I'm thinking, 100 times more people close to it that were protesting them, you got to make sure that things remain peaceful. So then, of course, there was Supreme Court saga continues with Justice Gableman correcting his story and saying that he was assaulted now in September of 2009, not 2008. Not sure how much that changes anything, but there's some good things that Justice Abrahamson is proposing, and we'll see where that goes. And, of course, probably the biggest story of the week turned out to be the DOT memo that was circulated saying that Wisconsin residents should not be provided free IDs to which we're all entitled for the purposes of voting unless people specifically ask for them. And this was becoming a bigger story. The next story came out that the person at the DOT who began circulating that email was fired. And, of course, as always, a reaction creates a bigger story. And now we're all talking about Chris Larson, not the senator. And I understand formerly DOT's Chris Larson has a different spelling of his last name than the senator. But nonetheless, what's going to happen? And are people getting fired for promoting the policies that are officially written down? And It's more than a little unnerving, and I'm really kind of curious to see what's going to happen next week with this one, because it sends a really bad message, and I think the governor has been trying to control his bad PR to whatever extent he is able to. For instance, as you recall, when the word came out that he was going to close, not all after the voter ID law, he was going to close all of these DOT centers to make registering for voting even harder. That was such bad fallout that decision was reversed, and now they're supposedly going to build more, although I will believe it when I see it.
All right, you have. I don't mean to cut you off, but we did have Chris Larson on. He did talk a little bit about it. That was really exciting to hear him come on. So glad you brought up that story. You have about 20 seconds before I have to get going and get off the air here.
All right.
So tell me, what do you think is coming down the pike for next week? Really fast, quickly.
Well, what's coming down pike next week is that the Senate and Assembly are going to be back in session. We're going to see what they're doing. There's a lot of recalls were not entirely successful. I think we're going to see more of Walker's agenda and more of the ALEC agenda resurface, and that's not going to be pretty, so get prepared to protest.
All right. Well, thank you so much. That was Yuri Raskin, and I don't have much time left, so he'll be on next week. So thank you so much for listening today. You can listen to us on iTunes. Don't forget, we'll be on WIDE next Saturday. And I will see you next Saturday. Remember, Wisconsin Forward, together forward. Have a great week, everybody.
Order, 14 senators. Capital disorder, 14 senators. New Wisconsin heroes. What's the score? Senators 14, Governor Walker 0. What's the score? Senators 14, Governor Walker 0. Governor 0.